This is New England Public Radio's Jazz Beat. I'm Tom Reaney with a podcast edition of my jazz blog, which you can find at nepr.net. Today's podcast focuses on Bob Dylan, Mike Bloomfield, and the Paul Butterfield Blues Band at the Newport Folk Festival on the weekend of July 23rd through 25th, 1965. The podcast features recordings by Dylan, Butterfield, and Muddy Waters. Paul Butterfield plugs in, and Dylan follows suit. July 25th marked the 50th anniversary of Bob Dylan going electric at the Newport Folk Festival. The milestone is being widely commemorated, and it follows the sale 2 years ago of the Fender Stratocaster he played that Sunday night. Elijah Wald's new book, Dylan Goes Electric, Newport, Seeger, Dylan, and the Night That Split the 60s, tells the story more accurately and contextually than any previous renderings. Published by Day Street, it's a great read that's getting plenty of attention, including a glowing review in the New York Times, where Janet Maslin expressed surprise that there's more to the myth of Dylan's sonic assault on Newport than what's been contemplated ad nauseum for a half century. My interest in that epical weekend has long been focused on the leading role the Paul Butterfield Blues Band played in bringing electricity and Chicago blues to Newport. They were also the first racially integrated ensemble to play the festival since it was established in 1959. Butterfield led a pedal-to-the-metal amplified outfit, and that was part of its legend. The band's debut LP, released in October 1965 on the previously acoustic-only Elektra Records, underscored this feature in a back cover banner unique in music history. It read, "We suggest you play this record at the highest possible volume in order to fully appreciate the sound of the Paul Butterfield Blues Band." I wrote a feature on the festival 2 years ago when news broke of Dylan's guitar being sold at Christie's for $965,000. I found it silly hearing one news anchor after another talking about Dylan's guitar playing when it was actually Mike Bloomfield blazing in the background. But who pays attention to such detail? Vintage Guitar Player does. The magazine's October 2015 issue has a nice feature with G.E. Smith playing Bloomfield's Telecaster and proclaiming the Butterfield Blues Band's influence. The article is called "The Guitar That Killed Folk Music." Elijah Wald's emphasis is different and more comprehensive than mine, but as a blues historian and performer, he addresses the phenomenon of white boys playing the blues head-on, and he provides a fresh new account of Butterfield's Friday afternoon opening set at Newport, one which began with Alan Lomax's disparaging introduction of the band. Lomax was among the few folklorists to have embraced rock and roll as a valid folk form, and he hailed the Chambers Brothers' performance at Newport as exemplars of our modern American folk music, rock and roll. But he was less impressed by the prospect of a 22-year-old white blues harpist fronting the first Chicago blues band ever to appear at Newport. Lomax knew from blues, 24 years earlier, while on a Library of Congress field recording sojourn, he discovered Muddy Waters in Clarksdale, Mississippi. The discovery occurred a year or more before Butterfield and guitarist Michael Bloomfield were even born, and their youth only added to Lomax's doubts about their ability to deliver the real thing. Unbeknownst to Lomax, Muddy had encouraged Butterfield when the aspiring blues harpist began hanging out at the Southside Blues Clubs where Muddy held forth in the late 50s. Bemused at first by the presence of a lone white teenager in his midst, Muddy soon began inviting Butterfield onto his stage, and in 1969 he recorded the classic Fathers and Sons with Butterfield and Bloomfield.
40 days and 40 nights, since my baby left the town. Why she left, I just don't know.
Lomax's intro of the Butterfield Blues Band was snide and presumptuous. He complained to the audience about having to wait for the band to set up, and Wald's account has him saying that Butterfield had come highly recommended, already the king of Chicago. I'm anxious to find out whether it's true or not. Albert Grossman, who'd become Dylan's manager in 1962, was a Chicagoan who'd urged that Butterfield be booked by the festival, and he didn't take kindly to Lomax's condescension. When the two confronted each other offstage, blows were exchanged, and the culture war that split the decade had begun. It's my contention that all the buzz about Butterfield and the fight between Grossman and Lomax combined to make Dylan rethink his Newport plans. Wald doesn't go quite that far, but he allows that many insiders suggest the fight left Dylan itching to stick it to the folk music establishment. He adds that Dylan was inspired by the presence of the Butterfield Band, which he'd seen in person at the Village Gate a month earlier, and had known Bloomfield for a couple of years. While they'd yet to release more than one single, the band already had a reputation among those in the know. That weekend, Dylan told a Time magazine reporter, "For me, right now, there are three groups, Butterfield, the Byrds, and the Sir Douglas Quintets." Dylan had already gone electric in January of 65 when he jumped down the manhole of Subterranean Homesick Blues and scored his first chart success. Like a Rolling Stone, recorded a month before Newport with Bloomfield playing the song's signature leads and turnarounds, was all over the radio by the festival weekend.
Once upon a time, you're dressed so fine. Bumps of dime in your prime. Then you, people call, said beware, call your mind before. You thought they were all hitting you.
Elijah Wald recounts that Dylan arrived at Newport on Saturday and asked Bloomfield to assemble an ad hoc outfit that would back him on his main stage set the following night. The group, which rehearsed all night at a Newport mansion leased by George Ween, coalesced around Butterfield's rhythm section, bassist Jerome Arnold and drummer Sam Lay, players who'd honed their chops with Little Walter and Howlin' Wolf. Barry Goldberg, a sidekick from Chicago, played the B3 on Like a Rolling Stone at Newport, while Al Cooper, who was the organist on the record, played bass in place of Arnold, who fumbled the changes. Cooper had come to Newport on his own as a paying customer, but shortly after his arrival was handed backstage passes and deputized for the band. 6 weeks earlier, he'd arrived at the Highway 61 Revisited session, assuming he'd play guitar. But as he's humbly related ever since, "Just hearing Bloomfield warm up ended my career as a guitarist. Until then, I'd never heard a white man play guitar like that." Of course, only Bob Dylan can say definitively how much his decision to go electric was inspired by the events swirling around Butterfield that weekend. But as far as I'm concerned, if Butterfield wasn't there, Dylan's electric premiere wouldn't have happened until a later date. What is certain is that Newport 65 certified two significant developments in popular culture: Dylan-esque folk rock, and Butterfield as the new archetype of the white blues man. The latter is a complex phenomenon lying deep in the American grain, ranging from 19th-century blackface minstrelsy to the jazz singer, from Paul Whiteman as the king of jazz to Benny Goodman as the king of swing to Elvis Presley as, simply, the king. Dylan, the troubadour who's continually channeled blues mythology and elements of its floating verses, may be the ultimate exemplar of the phenomenon. He acknowledged as much with his 2001 album Love and Theft, which borrowed its name from Eric Lott's 1993 book Love and Theft, Blackface Minstrelsy and the American Working Class. Dylan's penchant for disguising his sources brings to mind T.S. Eliot's adage, "Talent imitates, genius steals." Butterfield was more an imitator than a thief, and at Newport he put his stamp on classics by Elmore James, Junior Parker, and three tunes by Little Walter. He also sang the newly minted signature song of his rough-and-tumble hometown, born in Chicago. The song's composer, Nick Rabinides, was part of the entourage that traveled to Newport with Butterfield, and he sang a couple of tunes with the harpist at one of the festival's blues workshops. Elijah Wall quotes Barry Goldberg saying, "We always carried that sort of Chicago toughness, an attitude embodied in Rabinides' song about friends lost to gunfire on the streets."
Well, my father told me, son, you had better get a gun.
Butterfield's musicianship earned him the respect of the masters, especially Muddy Waters and B.B. King, as well as lesser-known figures around Chicago. His first steady gig was with guitarist Smokey Smothers and a group that included Jerome Arnold and Sam Lay. When success came his way, he and Bloomfield continually acknowledged the originators and helped raise the quality of the venues they played, including the Fillmore West. As Sam Lay has said, "Butterfield opened doors for black musicians, and I know because I followed him through those doors." Billy Boy Arnold said as much when he spoke at the induction of the Paul Butterfield Blues Band at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this spring. Arnold, whose 50s originals I Wish You Would and I Ain't Got You were famously covered by the Yardbirds, noted that it wasn't until Butterfield brought his integrated band into Chicago's North Side clubs that black bluesmen like himself began headlining there, too. Dylan instructed Bloomfield not to play any of that B.B. King shit when he recruited him for the Highway 61 sessions. The directive has often been misconstrued as a slam against blues, but even a quick perusal of Dylan's memoir or a set list from Theme Time Radio Hour reveals his love for the music and icons like Muddy Waters, Little Walter, and Sonny Boy Williamson. But the blues form would have limited his scope and imagination as a songwriter, and he just didn't have the chops as a guitarist or harmonica player to do much more than shadow the masters. However, that hasn't stopped him from employing a succession of guitar players, including Danny Freeman, Jimmy Vaughn, Doyle Bramhall, Charlie Sexton, and Duke Robillard, who are disciples of the late King of the Blues. But he's challenged them to play beyond their comfort zones. Bloomfield was the first of them, and Dylan's never stopped hailing him. As recently as a 2009 interview with Rolling Stone, he said, "The guy that I always miss and I think would still be around if he stayed with me was Mike Bloomfield. He could just flat-out play. He had so much soul, and he knew all the styles. He was an expert player and a real prodigy. He started playing early. He could play like Willie Brown and Charlie Patton. He could play like Robert Johnson way back in the early 60s. He could play that pure style of country blues authentically." While Bloomfield dispensed with blues licks on Highway 61, it was the bluesy bite of his Telecaster and Butterfield's authoritative singing and a Little Walter-inspired harp that raised the first clatter at Newport 50 years ago. Elijah Wall quotes festival performer Jeff Muldaur on Butterfield's impact. "The most important thing to happen at Newport in 1965 was that an integrated band came in from Chicago to play real Chicago blues. And this white guy was so good and had a band that could pull it off and hold their own among the kings. In the blink of an eye, there would be 200,000 blues bands in the world based on that model." Those countless bands, however, have only rarely mirrored the integrated nature of the Paul Butterfield Blues Band. Butterfield's own groups remained a mix of blacks and whites, and so too the bands led by his Chicago compatriot Charlie Musselwhite. But under the Butterfield archetype, blues, which was in decline in popularity among blacks in the early 60s, underwent a sweeping makeover. And over the past 50 years, it's become a music with a predominantly white face. That's a complicated story for another time and space at this blog, but it's a major legacy of Newport 1965.
Look over yonder's wall.
For more on Bob Dylan, Paul Butterfield, and Mike Bloomfield, including concert clips, visit the jazz blog at nepr.net. Thanks to Katie Wright for production assistance. For Jazz Beat, I'm Tom Reaney.